this is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today I have with me in the studio Seattle poet Sharon Cumberland. Welcome to the show, Sharon.
Thank you, Sheila.
Sharon Cumberland's poems have been published in many literary journals, including Plowshares, Iowa Review, Image, and the Beloit Poetry Journal. She has been awarded Calliope's Sue Saniel Elkin Award, the Pacific Northwest Writers Association Zola Award for Poetry, and the Writers Haven Press Bright Side Award. Peculiar Honors, a full-length collection of poems, was published by Black Heron Press in 2012. Her chapbooks are The Arithmetic of Mourning from Green Rock Press and Greatest Hits 1985 to 2000 from Pudding House Press. She has been a resident artist at Yaddo, in Saratoga Springs, New York, the Jack Straw Foundation in Seattle, and the Grunewald Guild in Plain, Washington. She was the poet in residence at the Seasons Music Festival in Yakima and has given poetry meditations at churches throughout the region. She is also the founder and member of the Greenwood Poets at the Greenwood Senior Center in Seattle. A lifelong Episcopalian, she spent 2 years as a member of the Order of St. Helena and 1 year at the Catholic Worker in New York City. She is now a professor of English at Seattle University, and her collection, Strange with Age, was published by Black Heron Press in 2017. Sharon, I'm so happy to have you here in the studio with me today.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
We've been friends for a long time, since early in your days in Seattle and early in my poetry writing career. Earlier, that's for sure. We're going to talk about your poetry today, and it's exciting that your newest book has been out so recently. So I wonder if we can start out with having you read from that book.
Okay, I'd love to. The book is called Strange with Age. It's out by Black Heron Press.
Which is a Seattle press.
It is. It's in Mill Creek. Jerome Gold is a wonderful publisher, and I'm delighted with this book. It's called Strange with Age because I was writing it while helping my sister take care of my 95-year-old dad, who recently passed away, but he got to see this book before he died. Strange with Age is a crown of sonnets, so that's 7 sonnets, which I'm going to spare you. I won't read them to you now, but I will read one poem about my dad that I put on my Christmas card, and everybody got some sense of the state my dad has been in. And it's called Wow, Wow, Wow. Wow, wow, wow is what my father says when he sees me from his hospital bed. Wow, wow, wow. And he juts his withered old thumb up in the air. He has forgotten his proper nouns. When those people went from where they were to where they were going, he says, meaning when his parents, Opal and Cumby, left H Street and moved to Newton Street, why, I was there, and the school was over there, and the place where you got candy was over there. Wow! He goes from D.C. to Orlando to the Naval Academy to Rome in no particular order. It's like a crazy quilt, he tells me. You never know which patch you'll land on from 1 minute to the next. Now he's toddling down Newton Street, now spooning soup into my senile mother at Huntcliffe Summit, now on the gun deck of the USS Bristol, now driving Mom and me to Ostia Antica in the old Austin Princess a Foreign Service officer sold him for 200,000 lira. You're going to like it, Sharon, he says, pointing skyward. You never know where you're going next.
How dear that poem is.
He was a very good old man in the sense that as life slowed down and possessions fell away and rooms got smaller, he never lost his good humor. He never actually lost his cognition, so he knew us until the very end.
Yeah.
And he was just, he was a great dad, but he was a very good old man.
And he shared some very deep philosophy, as you captured in that poem. Thank you. So, it's been a journey getting to this publication, and I wonder if we could talk about the beginnings of that journey and kind of follow you through it a bit with your poems.
When I think about how I became a poet, I love this publication that Pudding House Press put out because this Greatest Hit series was an invitation for about 100 poets to just send in their best poems. But another thing they asked for was an essay where you really had to sit down and think about how you came to be a poet. And I understand that I always wanted to be a writer. I grew up writing little poems, but for some reason, I had a lot of anxiety and I couldn't sort of make it happen. I loved reading. I majored in English in college. I'm a college professor of English. I have a PhD in English. But I didn't really start to write as a writer myself until my sister's little boy, Andrew Simpson, passed away at the age of 5 of leukemia. I was so devastated by this loss that I just started writing poems. I tell this story in an essay in this Greatest Hits chapbook of struggling to write 2 poems when I was living in New York City and then trying to find a poetry class. And there you had to sort of pass tests. You had to send in your poems to get in. But I only had 2 poems. You had to send in 5 poems. And everybody turned me down. One person said, well, I said, I only have 2 poems. And they said, write 3 more. I'd opened my veins to write the 2. But fortunately for me, a wonderful poet named Nancy Schoenberger, who was at the Academy of American Poets, took me into her class, even though I only had 2 poems. And that's when my writing career began. And being in New York City, I got to take wonderful classes with William Matthews and Stephen Dobbins and Sandy McClatchy, a lot of great writers that were available to anybody who could write 5 poems and get into their classes. So I did that for about 3 years until it was William Matthews who told me, now stop taking classes and just start writing and submitting. And you only need a few literary friends to look over your work. That's really what I started doing.
That's a fabulous story. He was my first advisor at the University of Washington.
How wonderful.
So this is many years later than when you met him. And always had fun things to say.
Yeah.
When I was going to present my thesis, which was a collection of my poems to date, he said, you know enough not to worry about this, don't you? And I looked at him and I said, no, I have no idea about that. So he seemed he had a knack for saying the right thing at the right moment.
He sure did. He told me, he said, find 3 literary friends. And he said, and I'll be one. Oh. I mean, what a generous offer. Mm-hmm. He said, what you have to do is learn their bias. And that way, when they say, I don't like this, you can say to yourself, well, you never like that. And then you can just listen to the other critiques and accept those. So that's really what's happened with the Greenwood Poets. In Seattle, I was invited to teach a class at the Greenwood Senior Center, which I did. And those seniors were the best students that I had ever had. And I'd been teaching at Seattle University for a while. While I love young students, I was quite startled by these older people who really had a lot to say. And they were determined to learn everything I had to tell them so that they could say what they wanted to say. There was a sense of determination and urgency. And so after that class was over, they asked me to keep going. And so we're in our 18th year, but I'm not a teacher anymore. They had turned themselves into a workshop while I was away one summer. And when I came back, they said, teach us again. And I said, no, I'm going to join your workshop. And so we've been on that footing ever since.
That's a great story. Would you like to read? I don't know if it's one of the first 2 poems, but I know you have a poem there about your early time writing because of your nephew's passing.
Yes, I have quite a few poems about Andrew. When I was just beginning to write, one of the things, since I had studied poetry in college, I knew all about the form, so I thought, I'll just write 1 poem in each form for my nephew. And my feeling about form, strict form, like sonnets, villanelles, and so forth, is that when your passions or your feelings are so intense, it helps to pour them into a vessel that's a rigid so that it doesn't fall apart. So I never wrote free verse about my nephew. I only wrote in the forms. And this poem is a villanelle. That's a form with repeating lines. As you hear it, you'll hear the lines repeat. It's called The Language Lacks a Necessary Slant. The language lacks a necessary slant for honoring a claim of family sorrow. There ought to be a word for grieving aunt, as wife's bereavement, no more permanent or complete, is recognized by widow. But language lacks a necessary slant, describing that same isolated want of her whose only child was a nephew. There ought to be a word for grieving aunt, as orphan is the word for infant severed from its mother, something empty, hollow. The language lacks a necessary slant, describing barren hours, days absent of hope, the flat, attenuated view. There ought to be a word for grieving aunt, who had that younger life, now sent through time to age alone. My only Andrew, the language lacks a necessary slant. There isn't any word for grieving aunt.
Brings tears.
Yeah. Even after all these years, yes. Andrew would be in his 40s now.
Grief is timeless. The poet Edward Hirsch has a wonderful book, which I'm sure you know, How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry. And in the book, he talks about Elizabeth Bishop's Villanelle, about parting. And he says the villanelle is the perfect form for retrieving loss. And I think it is. There it is. You said in the rigid vessel. There it is. That loss, that time. When grief was fresh.
I teach that villanelle one art.
One art.
It's so good about how to practice losing. And it's also a great way to show students that poetry is oblique, that you don't go straight at it the way you might in an essay, but that you round on to your subject matter.
That's a nice way to say it, round on. I'm thinking, too, of Theodore Retke's poem, whose title is escaping me, where he's writing as a professor. A student had died in a horse accident, I think, and it's the same position, saying, you meant something to me, but I am not the legitimate griever in the culture's eyes.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I'm married now, and I have a lovely family, but I don't have any children except my siblings, my nieces and nephews, who I dearly love, and all the thousands of students that I've had over all these years. And it's true, you're very secondary, but it doesn't mean that you're, or even tertiary, but it doesn't mean that your feelings are any less intense when you recognize.
It's a very valuable poem. Thank you. Would you like to read another from your earlier times as poet?
I know, I'm going to sound like a gloomy Gus poet because every poem I read is sort of about something, some kind of loss or grief. But I do have a lot of humor in my poetry. But this one is not one of those. When I first came to Seattle, I came from New York City. I was very, very fortunate to get my job at Seattle University. But I had a lump in my breast. And my insurance didn't start until September, and I was there in August. And so I went into major panic mode. But I found out what a great situation I was in when I went into Seattle University's HR department and told them my dilemma. And they just moved my insurance coverage back a month so that I could get treatment. And it turned out to be nothing. So I was very fortunate. But I did write this poem called Before because I realized if it didn't happen now, something similar to it is going to happen someday, as happens to us all.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Today, Sheila is speaking with Seattle poet and Seattle University professor Sharon Cumberland about her new collection of poems and her writing and teaching career.
This poem is called Before. Walk nude through the house, holding a breast in each hand, feeling their liquid weight shift as you walk, feeling as you lift them up that you are young again, that they are at once your children and yourself. Knowing that these companions rise and fall in solidarity with you, that you may have to give them up one by one to save yourself, that they will be sacrificed, these flowing solids, these kissing stations, these secret reservoirs for you, knowing that you will keen for them as for lost children, feel the guilty weight of blood money. Walk naked through the house, hold them now as you might cherish your old parents, your memories of youth. Ask forgiveness, be reconciled before they go. Fortunately, they haven't gone.
For so many women, they have. And the fear of that is so huge. And just the, when you know you're going to lose something of yourself for health reasons, just to be able to have that moment with you from that poem is the value of poetry.
It's a way of distilling your feelings for yourself and for others. I tell my students, you have to really learn to write the best poetry you can because you are writing for other people who can't write these poems. You know, my students are young and they tend to think that they're just, it's a form of self-expression. One of my earliest influences was Milton. I wrote my master's thesis about John Milton, not about Paradise Lost, but about his early poetry. And he believed himself to be a poet priest, somebody who was a vessel whose job was simply to channel the Holy Spirit so that he could communicate to the world. And in a real sense, I think that's what the job of poetry is it's a public service, and it's not just about you. You have to understand that you are a representative human being for all the other human beings, and that you're so that even though you have an experience like a lump in your breast, something that scares you, you have to remember, you have to do your best to write it because you're writing it for all the people who have that experience who couldn't write that poem, but it might help them to read that poem.
Would help them to read that poem. A cousin question I have for you is there are so many people who are afraid to read poetry, afraid to like poetry, afraid to experience poetry, that as poets we feel this very strongly that when our poems are done, they offer a human experience that's valuable to have offered. What do you tell your students, maybe, or any other person, about this fear of poetry?
That's a really good question because America didn't used to fear poetry. There was a whole group of poets called the schoolroom poets who wrote that familiar poetry that sort of describes our country to ourselves. Under the spreading chestnut tree, the village smithy stands, and the ride of Paul Revere, and so forth. But after the First World War, when modernism came in, Mallarmé in France, it sort of started in France and spread everywhere, he said that poetry was wasted on the vulgar bourgeoisie and that it should be taken out of their hands and placed only in the hands of the elite. Poetry became a very elite kind of an art. People didn't understand it. As beautiful as the works of Ezra Pound and as beautiful as T.S. Eliot's works are, it's not the kind of work that you can read in the sixth grade, that you can recite, stand up and recite for your classmates the way my grandmother did. My grandmother, to her dying day, could recite long passages of great American poetry from her era. I've been thinking about writing an essay called Why I Love Billy Collins.
Because of his Poetry 180?
Yeah, because I think that he is really in this great strain of American schoolroom or fireside poets that had faded out and that is beginning to come back again. When I was trying to get my early poetry published in New York, I had a very hard time. I mean, I waited a long time to get my work out. I had to wait for the temper of the times to change, because my poetry is very clear and easy to understand, and it's in this tradition of the schoolroom poets. And in New York, I'd come close to winning contests, I'd come close to getting published, but people would come back to me and say, it's too simple. I even had one editor say, you should have one incomprehensible line of poem. I think he was kidding, but he wasn't really kidding.
I want to write a poem from that premise.
Which is the incomprehensible line. But times have changed. The pendulum is swinging back. Poetry is like water. It will always belong to the folk. And the folk never stopped writing, never stopped having classes, never stopped gathering in libraries and homes to read and write their own poetry. But it stopped being the kind of book that would even get reviewed in the New York Times. I remember clearly when the New York Times announced it would no longer review poetry books.
Have they backtracked on that?
No, they haven't.
Wow.
Unless you're a very big poet.
You say that we never stopped, the folk, never stopped writing and gathering and reading to each other. Yet our schooling somehow has made whole generations of people feel that they can't understand poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And is it because they were studying the poetry of the more elite poets and that replaced the study of the schoolhouse poetry in our schools?
I think that the work of the great modernist poets is very, very beautiful, and it's very much worth studying, and it's extremely rewarding. But it is so different from the poetry that just expresses the quality of people's everyday lives that people turn to other genres for that. Also, Television was looking more at the way people leave their ordinary lives. The digital world offered many, many alternatives to self-expression. So that poetry did seem to be a very elite thing, and this has lasted for enough generations that people like Mary Oliver and Billy Collins have come along to really bring poetry back. And then Garrison Keillor was such an advocate of poetry and presenting poetry as something that belongs to everyone and that can express everyone's experiences of life, that I think it's really caused the pendulum to swing back mm-hmm. so that people aren't as afraid of poetry.
Right. For me, when Robert Haas was our U.S. Poet Laureate, oh, yeah. and he was publishing poems in newspapers.
Yes.
With very little analysis.
Right.
And I think that's true for Ted Kooser mm-hmm. and Billy Collins wanted people in schools just to listen. And I think that was one thing that happened, too, when the poems seemed hard to understand. It was less value to just, well, let it in, see what you feel. What you feel is coming from the words
yeah.
and the sounds. We began, I think, in our education and our teachers to have to understand the poem. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that you have to understand a poem to receive its information. By receiving it, you have understood it.
Yeah.
So that said, how about reading us another poem?
One of the things I lately have been trying to do is to respond to the things that move me in some way, even if it's in a bad way. So I sometimes have my students write newspaper poems where they just have to read the newspapers and find themselves moved. Poetry, I think, begins with strong feelings. Even if you're laughing hard at something, you're weeping at something, you're angry at something, even profound boredom can lead to good poetry. I do the same. So this is a poem I'm going to read now called 20 Young Men.
And I want to say that you're reading from your new book.
Yes, from Strange with Age. I was reading the newspapers one day, and there was a photograph of some people who were being executed by ISIS. And it was such a disturbing picture to me of men in black standing behind kneeling young men in orange prison suits. And these men had big knives in their hands, and clearly they were going to execute these young men in front of them. I think of it as a form of prayer to say, okay, how does a person respond to such a thing? And I've been thinking in terms of changed narrative, where you look at something and you just try to imagine another way that this could resolve itself. I don't know in any kind of concrete way in the world what effect this has on the universe, but this is the poem that I wrote about that. It's called 20 Young Men. 10 men are dressed in orange prison suits, their hands bound behind their backs. 10 more in black uniforms, faces swathed in black scarves. Each man is matched with another, orange, black, as they march in sand along the shore of a silent sea. The men in orange kneel. Each black-clad man stands behind with a knife. We fear the worst, and in this universe, the worst happens. But in that other place, the place of peace, the men in black drop their knives and throw their masks into the sand. They unbind their brothers and help them step out of their prison suits. They shed forever their black uniforms. Now 20 young men stand nude in the bright sun. They turn to the sparkling sea and run into the water, each man diving and splashing until he is cool and refreshed. They help each other on the shore and into the shade, share tea and sugar dates, discuss their future plans, a marriage, an import-export business, a wing on the house for an old parent for children. They say, I would like to know more about you, who are so much like me.
Beautiful ending.
Thank you.
Thank you. If only.
I know.
And what a lesson, right?
Well, I sort of feel like if you can't imagine it, it can't happen. So the imagination is extremely important. You have to be able to look at the world and imagine a better world. Because if we can't do that, then we can't move towards it.
Yeah, and so much of our entertainment doesn't imagine that.
No.
Oh, big sigh. I don't want to put you on the spot, but had you selected a funny one to read?
No, that sort of says something about me, but I have selected a pleasant one. This poem is called The Marriage at Cana, and what I have been doing is moving through the life of Jesus. I call him Yeshua in my poems, and I just take incidents out of his lives and write poems about it. But I use what's called a boot ream, which is I take a Shakespearean sonnet or a sonnet from Keats or somebody, and I steal the 14 end rhyming words and I build them into the poem. And that way, one of the things poets do using forms or various other devices is to put barriers in front of themselves, because it's more fun to write that way than to just write smoothly or to write prose. I always say to my students, if you just want to go straight forward and tell something, write an essay. But poets like barriers. Poets like to jump over barriers. So I said, think about whether you're going to be a sprinter running around a track or whether you're going to be a hurdler. Poets are hurdlers. We like to jump over stuff like rhyme and various problems that you propose to yourself. So in writing these poems, I take these 14 words, and my rule is that they have to be the 14 words from a famous sonnet. They have to be used in order, and I can't change the words themselves. But I can have as many lines as I want to in between.
Okay.
So this is called The Marriage of Cana. The miracle is that anyone can love, look eye to eye without turning away, that youth exchanges urgency for order, man with his bristling arrows, woman with her reservoir of life, seasons die and revive, husband, wife. Yeshua is young himself. He wants to stamp his feet, slap his thighs, sing at this wedding. He wants to look at girls whose toes have tiny silver bands, whose veils have little trilling bells. He wants to flick his fingers and ring the little bells. He wants to braid and tangle, run, pursue. There is no verb for all he wants to do. He says yes to everything, skewered goat, wedding bread, and to his mother, pressing him for wine. Why should he subdue his gift within the logos of his mind? Yeshua gives the wedding guests the best wine ever made. He may as well, even though it's not his time. The end, he knows, is swelling on the vine. Only the sober steward stands transfixed by water deepening into scarlet, spiraling through the amphorae. He tastes it. By the staff of Moses, he cries. What time destroys it cannot uncreate. The bridegroom sits beside his happy bride, worlds on the brink. Yeshua sings, dances, drinks, commits. He feels as though he's wedded everything.
Thank you, Sharon. What a wonderful thing to remember, as if wedded to everything. I think we should all remember that for many, many reasons. The world would be peaceful. But also as poets, we are wedded to everything.
Yes.
Thank you so much for sharing your work and your insights and your knowledge.
Thank you for inviting me.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.